So you may have heard just before the top of the hour, we had this little technical difficulty because for some odd reason, I can communicate only to some people involved in the show tonight. So, and something ended up on the air there, and then that killed a bumper that we were playing into the top of the hour. And well, never mind. But we're all good now. We just wanted to say goodbye to Jason the Horse, who had us on last hour. And yes, the tweets are still coming in at Deacon Punnett. People asking, so let me get this straight, as I believe it was Diane, who said, I just tuned in. Your guest has a horse soul? And yes, Diane, he does. And if you missed the last half hour, I hope you go back and grab that and find that in the podcast. So, Jason, thank you for agreeing to come back on with us again and for your reflections both on your particular case and on other people. And just know that no matter where we end up, wherever on this bridal path of life that we should find ourselves, I was always glad you reached out to me in the beginning, and I appreciated your spirit, whatever kind of spirit it was that you were willing to share with us on the air on Coast to Coast.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I was wondering, would you mind if I maintain contact with you through the method by which I have before, when I, I've mailed to you, matter mail, so to speak, or snail mail?
You can, and I look forward to hearing from you. Okay.
All right.
Talk to you soon, and thank you to Shirley for being kind enough to hang on too on Coast to Coast. She's a longtime Coastie. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Ian. Well, I'm going to give you one from Bob Hope. Thanks for the memories. You were talking about D.B. Cooper, and the night that he jumped out of that airplane, I was driving to Vancouver, Washington in my car with my three kids. It was Thanksgiving Eve. And it was, I just kept looking up in the sky going, what if he falls down in front of me?
Yeah.
And it was, of course, all the Twitter. And I've always enjoyed listening to you bring it back up. And I'm just hoping that someday that the gentleman that is trying to prove this case gets his just due. And I was also wondering about the Charles Lindbergh child.
Yeah, the man who said that he was the Lindbergh baby. The last time I attempted to get him back on the air again, he too was in frail health. And I didn't ask about it this time. But you know what? I will. And thank you, Shirley. I will see if I can't tweet out more on that some point in the future. And let me grab Damien here real quickly because he was nice enough to hang on too. And then we'll get to Peter Lavenda. This hour, it'll be World War II and World War Z on our look back. And Damien,
hi.
Thanks.
Yeah, actually, I was browsing Facebook and I just saw that tonight was your last show. And I was really saddened all of a sudden because I remember, I think the first show I heard of you was back in 2006 when you interviewed Daniel Pinchback. I don't know if you remember that interview with him.
Tell me about that. I remember the name.
Yeah, he's actually, he was a New Age author. He wrote 2012, The Return of Tesla Kowat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I liked him a lot.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and just through the years, I feel like you're so conscious and you've really brought these really interesting, whimsical concepts to Coast. So I'm just really saddened to hear you go. And I don't know. In some circles, they say like tinnitus is a sign of spiritual awakening. I don't know.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
That's fun. I'll take that. And if this is a spiritual awakening, I'm willing to take that wake up call. If someone would just tell me how to pick up the damn phone. So thank you. And thank you too for Peter Lavenda hanging on next. We'll find out what more he has learned about Hitler in hiding. And then it's only appropriate since we played a little Mel Brooks at the top of the hour, Springtime for Hitler from the producers, that we go back and we grab a little from Max Brooks, his son and the author of the book World War Z that became the basis for this summer's blockbuster of the same name. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Giving a shout out to Conrad and Susan and Ann and Nusha and Tori and Scott and whoever it is over at hosepimp.com, who is now following me on Twitter. at Deacon Punnett. Hosepimp.com. There's more to that story. I just know it. I just don't know what it is yet. But there's more to the story of Adolf Hitler, too. And Peter Lavenda has been following it on Coast to Coast AM, as well as many other bits of crypto history. Good evening, Peter.
Good evening, Ian. Good to hear from you.
Always a pleasure. And your books on sinister forces, the grimoires of American political witchcraft, still fascinating. And your reviews, your supporters, you're always up to something. And I love that about you. I do. I love, and as I've said before, you cannot read a book by Peter Lavenda, even if you disagree with him, without following all of the footnotes, all the different ways in which Peter is able to maintain this high level of credibility, even in incredible subjects.
Thank you very much. That's really kind of you.
Yeah, but it's really true. Now, that having been said, one of the things which came up recently when I was asking people who do they want to have on again was you, because we did this amazing show on Adolf Hitler, which people were talking about, the Ratline book, Soviet Spies, Nazi Priests, and the Disappearance of Adolf Hitler. Before we go any further into what you may have learned since you've been on, let's talk about your main claim in the book Ratline.
Sure. Well, it starts off with an explanation that Nazis did escape after the end of the war, as we all know. Many very high-ranking Nazi war criminals managed to get out to the Middle East or to Latin America. But the core of Ratline is that there was another leg of the escape routes that led to Southeast Asia, something that of which I was not aware before. And the reason I became aware of that was because a German doctor, so-called doctor, died in Indonesia in 1970, leaving behind a cache of documents, all concerning the Ratlines. He was believed by some people to actually have been Adolf Hitler, due to a lot of similarities in physical appearance, but also to other coincidental, synchronistic kinds of connections. And he was seen in 1960 by an Indonesian man, a medical doctor, a real medical doctor, and a member of the Indonesian military. And he came across him in 1960, was fascinated by him. And years later, he started following up the story because he began to read about Hitler and noticed so many similarities. So initially, I thought that was just far-fetched and completely, erroneous, until a friend, Nick Valentoni, had gone to Moscow to prove that the skull the Soviets had claimed was Hitler's skull was not Hitler's skull at all. That was in 2009, and suddenly the field was wide open. There was no forensic evidence to show that Hitler had ever died in the bunker or anywhere else, for that matter. So I began to look at the other story in Indonesia more closely, and Ratline was the result of that. Just so many strange stories coming out of Indonesia about a Nazi party organization there in the 1920s and 30s that had been created by one of Hitler's closest friends. All of this is very well documented. There was a lot of reasons why, if Hitler had chose to escape, he would not have gone to South America, because he could not trust his fellow Nazis, especially after the assassination attempt. And at the end of the war, when everybody seemed to be turning against him, he would have gone somewhere far, far away. And I think he chose perhaps the furthest place he possibly could have, and that would have been a small island in the Indonesian archipelago.
It's a really interesting point that I think some people need to consider, that Adolf Hitler's biggest enemies were his opportunistic friends.
Oh, and yes, that for sure.
They would have traded in on him in order to line their pockets, save their souls, whatever. And that Hitler didn't know who he could trust at some point. And if it's true that he was able to escape from Germany, it would be a fallacy to say that he could have gone down to South America and restarted the Third Reich, even in the mountains of Brazil or Uruguay or wherever.
Certainly. I don't think that would have been a safe bet for him. I think he was paranoid enough after the assassination attempt, when his own generals were trying to kill him, and then when Heinrich Himmler was cutting side deals with the Allies and Goering was cutting deals and everybody seemed to be against him, the only people who were close to him oddly enough, were some of the people we never hear about. And one of them was Walter Havel. And Walter Havel had marched with him in the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923, had gone to jail with him. We hear very little about this guy. But he spent 10 years in Indonesia, 10 years setting up a Nazi party apparatus there between the wars, between World War I and World War II, and then was called back. And he was one of the last people to leave the bunker. So Havel was right there through the whole thing. They called him Surabaya Wali because he had spent so much time in Indonesia, particularly in Surabaya, which coincidentally is where this German doctor died in 1970, this mysterious man some people claim was Hitler.
And when we say doctor, it wasn't like he was doing a ton of doctoring.
No, no, he wasn't actually doctoring. He was more of an administrator, a hospital administrator, from everything I've been able to find out. And I have found out considerably more in the last 6 months or so.
Well, let's talk about that. So what have you learned since having been on with this on Coast to Coast AM?
Well, about 6 months ago, I was contacted by someone in Singapore who claimed that they had access to all of the documents left behind by this German doctor, including personal relationships with the family of the man who had discovered this Hitler person, in this putative or alleged Hitler in Indonesia. So I was very cautious about this. It sounded too good to be true. He managed to prove his good faith by sending me a couple of scans of documents that I had not seen before. So I went down and spent roughly the last 4 to 5 months, a lot of that time incommunicado, deep in Southeast Asia, where communications have not been easy and have been quite difficult, but in following up this particular story, and have seen the passports that this German used to get out of the country, out of Europe. I have seen some of his personal communications, photographs. The whole story is starting to pull together in some very startling ways. And most importantly of all, are the names that appeared in an address book that this person kept in the late 1940s, early 50s. And the names include some famous names from the rat lines, from the escape routes the Nazis used, as well as names of famous and prominent Nazi academics, even including one of the people who was closest to the Dalai Lama for most of his life, his personal home address in Tibet. So we had a treasure trove of information proving, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the man who died in Indonesia was a Nazi war criminal, if nothing else. If he was not Hitler, he was close to it, a person responsible for all sorts of war crimes, and a person who refused to leave his island under any circumstances, even though he could have at any time. He fled Europe and essentially became an Indonesian as far as he was able to, and yet confiding to the people closest to him that he was indeed Hitler.
Let's address the Eva Braun question, because it's been a while since I've read Ratline, which I read from cover to cover because it's just so darn good. But as I remember, Eva Braun went with him but then returned.
Yes. Eva Braun did not stay there. If this woman was indeed Eva Braun, she did not stay there. She, in fact, made four separate trips from Indonesia back to Europe before she finally left and stayed in Europe before he died. So she essentially left him. Her last trip coincided very strangely with the sickness and death of Eva Braun's father. So that last trip was her final trip. She went back to Europe just at the time when Eva Braun's father was sick and dying. And this another coincidence in a long series of coincidences concerning this case. So people who had seen her claimed that she was much younger than her husband, which would have been true for Eva. She was about, as I recall, 10 to 15, maybe 20 years younger. I forget the dates off the top of my head. But she was younger, blondish, blonde coloring. All of the physical characteristics seemed to match. And she basically got up and left. She couldn't take it in Indonesia for very long. She was only able to last for short periods of time before returning to Europe. This seems to indicate to me that this woman might indeed have been Eva Braun, because if she was the other woman whose passport it was supposed to have been, the other woman was an anthropologist. someone who was accustomed to long periods of time in foreign countries and who would have used that opportunity in Indonesia to do more field work. I shudder to think what kind of field work that might have been.
Yeah.
For Nazi anthropologists.
For Nazi anthropologists.
Yeah.
But if the theory is true that this was Adolf Hitler that went there to Indonesia, then he did remarry. And his wife after that had some unusual suspicions about her mysterious European husband.
Oh, sure. As I've been able to find out now through more documentation to which I've had access more recently, his Indonesian-born second wife was agitating, really, to have her husband take her to Europe. She wanted to see Europe, and she wanted to see Germany. And her husband said in the first place that it was too crowded. That Europe was too crowded, she wouldn't like it. Anyone who's been to Indonesia will find that kind of humorous. And then he said he felt safer in Indonesia and gave all sorts of excuses why. And she asked him about the war. And he was always very emotional when it came to discussing World War II. And he claimed that the whole story about Auschwitz and the death camps was all overblown. It was all nonsense. It never really happened. And when questioned about Adolf Hitler, oh, we don't know what happened the last days. Nobody knew anything. And he would change the subject in front of other people. But privately, between him and his second wife, the second wife said, you know, with that mustache and everything else, you look an awfully lot, a lot like Hitler, or pictures that she'd seen of Hitler. To which he actually replied to her, and she reported this a number of times to other people, he would pat his chest and say, "That's because I am Hitler. But don't tell anyone." And this is what he would tell his new wife in Indonesia. Mm. Now, is he just some old guy playing games with this woman? Was he really trying to tell her something? We don't know. But after he died, she talked to the Indonesian who first uncovered the story and told him that this man had no medical certificates. He had no medical diplomas of any kind. He didn't even have a birth certificate. He had no identification other than that passport that he brought with him out of Europe. And I have a long story about the passport.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story about how that passport and that photo of that doctor and that guy and all of that stuff gets wrapped around Ratline. We're talking with Peter Lavenda for just another minute more. So what's going to happen, Peter, with all of these updates that have been coming in? Do you have a new version of Ratline on the way, or is it a whole nother book?
Well, initially I thought there'd be no purpose in writing another book until I started to see everything that was available. So I actually have a manuscript nearing completion, tentatively titled Finding Hitler. And I'm working with publishers now to see if that can come out by the end of the year. It's going to have a lot more information, a lot more clarification of some of the mysteries that were in Ratline, but also a completely different expansion of this theme, including the fact that Ernst Kaltenbrunner, second in command of the SS at the end of the war, also tried to escape, having documents claiming that he was a medical doctor. And he had a genuine doctor's medical identification papers, plus a medical bag that he was taking when he was captured by the Allies. So this was a precedent. This was by no means something that was that unusual. If someone wanted to escape claiming they were a doctor, it was possible to do so.
Well, as you finish Finding Hitler, I'll write an email called Finding a New Host to Interview You, and I'll get somebody else here at Coast to Coast AM to continue this conversation with you and your good investigative work.
Well, best of luck to you, Ian. Thanks very much.
Enjoyed every time you were on every subject. Peter Lavenda. Find out more by linking up to him at coasttocoastam.com. From World War II to World War Z, one of my favorite moments on Coast to Coast was interviewing Max Brooks. I'll tell you a little bit more about the backstory to World War Z. Before there was World War Z, the movie, there was World War Z, the interview, next on Coast to Coast. Hey, Rick, thank you, Beverly, Annie, and Chris Crosby, who makes comics and runs a little company called Keenspot. Thank you for following me at Deacon Punnett on Twitter. Look forward to keeping the conversation going. And, oh, yeah, Joanne, who says, "I'm just a boring library technician who lives in Calgary." You may be just a boring library tech, but you're a boring library tech that has Ian Punnett as a follower. So I click on to many people tonight, and I'll be trying to follow as many as I can throughout the evening. So thank you so much for everybody that has made this last show of mine part of your night. And I thank Johan, who's standing by, sort of a representative. Thank you, Johan.
Well, thank you, Ian, for all your wonderful shows. I sure have appreciated it. And I just wanted to give you a quick update from Tarpon Springs, Florida, the famous sponge fishing town where I'm an amateur archaeologist. And at one point I called you and told you we found the Garden of Eden based on the landscape of Tarpon Springs matching up with Plato's Cretus in the garden and the Timorous City Road. And we found 2,000 stone anchors with holes along the west coast of Florida, which seems to give credence to the fact that this was the ancient Greek Garden of Hesperides. And then recently we found a portal to the underworld, which we call Persephone's portal to Hades.
And, you know, I think I'm going to have to have you hang on, and I'm going to get that number, and I'm going to pass you along to another host here on Coast to Coast that can continue that conversation on the air the way it should be done. So hang on, Johan, and we'll make sure that if there's another host that can do it, they will. And thank you so much for all that listing. All right, so stand by. We'll go from World War II to World War Z. And the one thing I did with author Max Brooks I had never done with any other author before. Coming up next on my final show on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. I was really looking forward to talking about the book World War Z, and at the last second I made a editorial decision that I wasn't going to tell Max Brooks that I was playing the subject straight and that I was going to talk to him as though everything in his book was an actual history of recent events. And that's what it sounded like when we did it on Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett.
I want to be one of the first shows to sort out the strengths and weaknesses of our country during this long and particularly dreadful experience. But for everybody else who is unfamiliar with exactly what happened over the course of the zombie war, and you think you can handle an honest accounting of it, stand by. This is going to be a show to remember. Before I bring up Max Brooks here, who's the author of this new oral history of World War Z, I want to give a little background on my experience with this, as some of you who are listening tonight have been kind of unable to listen to this show for a while. So you sort of have missed already a lot of the information that you would have liked to have had during this very scary period in both our national and international history. You know, some of you might know that by kind of a fluke, when the zombie epidemic was just beginning to hit, my wife and I had just sold our house, and we were planning on taking the summer off, so we were pretty liquid. We had bought an Airstream trailer. We had outfitted it with a small microphone processor that connected us back to the Coast to Coast studios in LA via a satellite phone, which we were just planning on using for the summer. And it was really just going to be sort of a fun thing to be able to kind of enjoy being free and out on the road. Well, it ended up being very fortuitous, and I'm very grateful that we were in that kind of a position. We know many others who didn't make it through this period because they stayed behind to try to fight for their home, or because they had a sort of a misguided sense of being able to fight this off on their own. Let me just say, maybe this is the first of a couple conversations we can have with Max Brooks. He was originally brought on to be the author of the United Nations post-war commission report, but had a conflict with how they were writing it. You know, that's kind of a whole other story, as many of us don't really accept the way the post-war commission report was written. And Max, can you talk a little bit about that, about how you thought the post-war commission report should have been written in the first place?
Yes, I can, and good to be here. I can say that the UN commission was positive point of view, unbiased and thorough and accurate. But it was remiss in denying what I like to call the human factor, the emotions and the personal stories. They were much more concerned with the facts and figures. How many died? When did they die? Where did they die?
What do you think, what was behind that? Some people have said, and certainly got said on this show for a period of time after the report came out, that they were trying to cover up the true horror of it by just trying to stick to the numbers.
Well, I think just by sticking to the numbers, they were trying. I believe that they thought it was in everyone's best interest to look past the emotion. I think they believe that had we been a little more dispassionate before the crisis got out of hand, it might not have gotten out of hand in the first place. I think they were trying to be logical and rational, but by this point, the horse was out of the barn.
Right.
There was no
point. Yeah. And they couldn't have known that. And we're just, I think many of us are just beginning to understand how bad things were before it became almost the death knell for humanity. And so perhaps then you can fill us in on some of these blanks tonight. Like the very first, the patient zero, the very first case of, you know, what some people call, what are the various names for it? Besides zombieism, what were some of the things that people called the very first case of the Walking Dead? What do they call it?
Well,
the walking plague.
There was African rabies that was that was misdiagnosed.
Right.
That was one of them. There was various plagues. As you said, walking plague. Pretty much every culture, every country, every organization had a different name.
But the first one, do we know for sure that the first case was in China?
No. No, we don't. You have to remember, when we talk about the first case, we're only talking about the first known case.
Can you talk about what we know about that case? What did you find as a historian, as an oral historian, at least to get us closer to the seminal event of the zombie war?
Well, I think automatically we know that the first case was not the first case, because the Chinese government clearly already knew and already had a plan in place. And how would they have if this was the first case? So I think that was the most important thing that we
found. That's interesting, right? We certainly didn't know that. So they had had some, either out of superstition, out of some, what had maybe have been considered by some to be folklore, or because they had had previous actual scientific knowledge of it, they were already preparing for a zombie outbreak in China.
Exactly. Clearly, they knew something at the highest levels of government, which might have been years in the making, or it might have been months. We simply do not know.
Anything in the plans that were drawn up by the Chinese government, and this, we're talking about the old Chinese government back when they were communist before the war, do we know anything in the plans that indicate how, if they knew the origin of it, was it a virus? Was it something that came down from space? I mean, did they give any indication at all that they were already working on a cure, or had isolated, you know, the catalyst which created the Walking Dead?
No, the Chinese government at the time dealt with the problem the way they dealt with any problem, which was to simply exterminate the carriers, which fit into very classic Maoist philosophies of how to deal with an opposing ideology.
And so they did this through establishing, like, local reporting through neighborhood doctors, that kind of a thing. And if they found somebody, they rounded them up and they just dispatched them.
Well, the genius of the Chinese was they did not try to hide their sweeps. They just hid what they were sweeping for. They knew they could not hide those kinds of sweeps, that the world would be watching. And so they simply invented a cover-up, that they were sweeping for dissidents, they were sweeping for counter-revolutionaries. So when the trucks would roll in the middle of the night, people were taken out and never came back, there was an explanation.
And the people they were taking away, I mean, this is really key, because I think we as human beings, we're unprepared for when somebody that we either know to be or suspect to be dead is still living, to think that somehow they've turned into a zombie. I mean, our first, you know, thought is to somehow contextualize this in a way in which we can understand it. So we would say they have a disease, they have leprosy, they have something, they're mentally, you know, incapacitated, there's something. But people were attempting to try to deal with them as though they were living. They didn't really understand that these were zombies.
No, and that's the case with any new plague. This is nothing new. This is how we as humans deal. We deal with something new as if it were old.
Right. We go to the familiar. But this didn't work. So tell me, what do we know to be? What's the story of the person that we, at least we can make a guess at being one of the earliest known victims? What do we know about them, him or her?
Well, all we know is that this little boy and his father were diving for relics in the lake created by the Three Gorges Dam. And we don't know what happened. We know the father disappeared. We know the boy came up with a bite on his foot. And from that point, it spread. And that's all we know.
Well, and that becomes very important, too. It would have been handy to have that kind of information up front, because then we would have had a better idea of the ability of zombies to survive underwater.
Would have saved a lot of lives.
Yeah. All right, now, so let's just fast forward a little bit. So how long did it take for the numbers in China alone to start getting out of hand? What year were we talking about, and how long was it before they began to alert the international community that they had a problem that was bigger than they could handle?
They never alerted the international
community. Ever. Never did.
Never. It was never an option.
Not unofficially, not under the table, never. Yeah. They just never said it. Oh, that is so criminal.
They never did.
So when does the word start to get out?
Well, it started with the Warmbrand Knight report, which was an Israeli Mossad analyst and an ex-CIA officer, which tried to sound the alarm. And, of course, that was ignored by everyone, of course, except Israel.
Was that because of the satellite photos? Is that what they were doing? Or
no, it was simply that that Israel and Taiwan have always had a close relationship. They were testing encryption software, and they knew that they kept seeing the word zombie. And they naturally thought it was a code word for something else.
Right.
Until they realized that it actually meant what it said.
Now, China later on tries to blame this whole thing on Taiwan, don't they?
Well, that was part of the cover-up, was to try to launch a sweep for counter-revolutionaries. And that was going to be explaining their sweep for the dead.
Gosh. What's the year? What year is it that when we first finally get a glimmer that this isn't just some weird weekly world news headline, right? That this isn't some tabloid report that can be dismissed with one of those, oh, there they go again to sell some newspapers. When our government really began to sit up and take notice that something was happening that may never have happened ever before.
Well, our government knew, we know, at least a year before the Great Panic.
Okay. They knew a whole year before.
They knew a whole year before. And to their credit, they did at least try to react. But you have to remember where America was at that point. They just did not have the resources. Americans had just had 8 years of a government that really stripped the government, stripped the economy, stripped the military. We were exhausted. We were tired. We were angry and frustrated. Nobody wanted to sacrifice anything more.
So the kind of reading the tea leaves on that, they thought the American people don't have the appetite for this. Even if we did tell them, it wouldn't be received. So let's go ahead and just send some money, throw some money at the problem, send over some academics. What's the first thing that our country does when it finally snaps into action a little bit?
Well, initially the idea was to respond in Africa. They believed it was African rabies. So the idea was to try and exterminate the sources in Africa, sending covert teams in country. That was one. The other one was trying to remove any of the threats that were coming into the country, but it was easily too little too late.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about threats coming into the country. Explain what that means. I mean, because they had already tried to set up, you know, checkpoints to catch people who had, you know, the swine flu, and to try and catch people who had SARS, and to try to, and you know, obviously that was that almost was sort of an interesting precursor for this. But
well, people had had enough of that. People had had enough of checkpoints and taking their shoes off and discovering their phones were being tapped and their emails read, and it ruined the credibility in the very same way that Watergate had ruined the credibility of the government in the 1970s.
Right.
In the very same way, actually, that the Vietnam War had destroyed America's morale for a long-term conflict.
Right. Right. We were anxious for mourning in America again, if
That's
you will.
Exactly where we were. We wanted our mourning, and no politician was going to tell us that twilight was giving way to darkness.
Right. That there was the Walking Dead. And is there any part of that which is kind of xenophobic anyway, where we're just sort of feeling like, well, that's their problem. That's not going to come around here. That's something they're going to have to deal with. I mean, was there any of that in the U.S. government at the time?
Well, I think that's always there. That's always there. America has always been an isolationist country. And always getting votes is important. Remember, you know, the politicians, the ones that knew, still had to answer to their constituents. And there's a very big difference between what they knew was right morally and whether they were going to lose their seat in the next election. And that's very important.
You know, we're coming up to the bottom of the hour, so there's so many questions still to get to with Max Brooks here about the history of World War Z. It's an oral history, so it's you know, there are individual stories from around the world, but when you put them all together, that tells the whole story to a larger degree than has been successfully done, I think. Max, let me ask you, if you can, just in a quick, give me 60 seconds on what the earliest zombies, how they were being described. How do people describe them? And did it change at all during the course of World War Z?
Well, of course it did. It began with human beings who were simply sick with some sort of virus, rabies. And by the end, we knew that these were dead bodies waking to kill and consume us.
But were they being described in terms of how they were acting differently? Like at the beginning, did they just say, well, they're just kind of catatonic, and then they became murderous? Or did people understand at the very beginning that you if you saw one, you had to run?
Well, initially, no. Initially, the idea was if a loved one you know is ill, be careful. They may not recognize you. They may be paranoid. They may lash out.
Right. Because I think that's so much part of the story. That's definitely what I was getting at, is that feeling that people had that this could still be treated. So some of the blame for this outbreak has to go not just into the realm of the political, but also the medical as well. And we'll get to all of that coming up. The oral history of the zombie war. Many of you lived it all too well. I know that many people lost loved ones to this, but we're going to talk about it anyway tonight. It's World War Z on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.